The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
Welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of our best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so this week, businesswoman and entrepreneur Sarah Newman talked to me about overcoming bankruptcy, stroke and depression, and discovering what really matters in life. Dentist of the Year Padraig O'Rochtagan told me how he helped a patient escape an abusive relationship after treating her broken tooth. And Dr. Mark A. Spencer told me about his work as a forensic botanist, which sees him weeding out murderers and solving the thorniest of crimes. That's it for this week. Thank you for listening. Hope you enjoy. My guest this morning has just joined us in studio, successful businesswoman, a high-profile entrepreneur, featured on the Dragon's Den TV show, then sold her business, needahotel.com, and then her story goes hither and thither, but for now, she joins us this morning. Sarah Newman, good morning.
Good morning, Ryan. How are you?
I haven't seen you for a long time because our paths would cross through TV and various things down through the years. So yes. How are you?
I am really good and very, very happy to be here. Thank you.
Your life has taken on sort of all sorts of swings and roundabouts, as has everyone's and as does everyone's. I suppose I'd love to talk to you a bit about, because you always have, obviously you have an English accent because you were born and bred in England.
Born and bred in England.
Give us a sense of young you and where you were school and that kind of thing.
I grew up, I was born in a town called Colchester in Essex, which is the oldest recorded town in Britain. And it used to be the capital of Britain before London. It was called Camelodon.
There you are, okay.
And I grew up in a lovely family, one brother and me, went to a lovely little private school for young ladies, although they may have made a mistake when they let me in.
Did you finish the finishing school?
Well, I left school at 16.
Yeah.
And my school reports that I was reading recently whilst clearing out some boxes with my mum.
Yeah.
Hi, mum. We were reading my school reports and giggling because they honestly all said, Sarah will never come to anything. Sarah talks too much. That's true. Sarah doesn't pay attention. I was banned from many classes for many different reasons. And I think it was just because I was not driven by academia.
The amount of times I sit here talking to people who have been very successful, very good people, who just didn't fit the school regimen. It just wasn't for them.
Yeah. The only teacher I think that really liked me was Miss Pendle.
Yeah.
And she was our cookery teacher. So I can make a very nice quiche.
Lorraine.
A quiche Lorraine, yeah, has been known. And an apple crumble was probably the first thing. And I still cook them. So, like,
Sarah,
thanks, Mrs. Pendle.
One of my greatest regrets is not having the opportunity to do home economics, because it would have prepared me for a life of disgrace in the kitchen.
Yeah.
And I could have reversed that entirely.
You could have been wonderful.
Yeah, but nevertheless, I want to come back to, how did you end up in Ireland then?
Well, I had been working in the travel business in the UK because I left school at 16. Mm. And I worked for one of the world's biggest wholesale tour operators after being turned down by British Airways because I wanted to be a long-haul air stewardess. But I failed the aptitude test. So my dreams of being a long-haul British Airways stewardess were totally shattered.
Yeah.
So I had to go into the back end of the travel business, which was wholesale tour operating. So I found my niche there, buying about 1,000 rooms a night in London and 1,000 rooms a night in Paris at wholesale discounted rates for the world's biggest wholesale tour operator. And then I moved to Ireland because, like every intelligent, hardworking, independent young woman, I met someone on a blind date at Dublin Airport and got married.
Who did you meet?
Well, he was my husband and the father of my children.
And you met him in...
In Dublin Airport.
On a blind date?
Yes.
I'm sorry, just explain that. I wouldn't mind a blind date, but how do you have a blind date at an airport?
Well, because you fly over and they collect you at the airport with a big bunch of flowers.
And whisk you off?
Yes.
Well, it worked out for... a time anyway, obviously.
Well, we have two beautiful children, Grace and Patrick, yeah, who are 24 and 23 now. So, yeah, the marriage didn't work out, but I think we did a really good job on the kids.
I bet you. And you stayed in Ireland then, obviously.
Yeah, that's the thing. So I've been here 25 years now.
You then, because I'm just curious about the air stewardess versus the business end of things. What did you want? Did you want, when you were younger, did you want glamour or did you want the greenbacks? Like what was
the aim? If you think back to when we were younger, we only had like about three channels on the telly.
That's true.
Okay. And I say, bring that back.
So do I, believe me.
Because there's too much choice.
Yes, yeah.
You can't decide what
to
watch.
Give the people choice.
No. The main thing is just say, these are the four channels or the three channels. Watch them and enjoy.
Yeah.
And, you know, luckily enough, Dallas was a really big hit. And I loved all that, you know, oil and aeroplanes and big houses and swimming pools.
Big hair,
big shoulder pads. And they all seemed to have so much fun. So I thought, I want my life to be exactly like that.
Well, you came very close to it, if not completely achieved that, because you set up your own business.
I did, in a one-bedroom apartment in Blackrock.
Needahotel.com.
Yes.
And that just went a bomb.
Yes, but it was quite hard work.
No, I know that, but due to that, it was a massive success.
Yes.
And what was the tipping point when did that sort of that fire take in terms of success?
Well, I set up the business in a one-bedroom apartment in Blackrock with no funding, and I just got married, and I was just pregnant with my daughter Grace, and I became a wholesale tour operator. So I was selling hotel rooms to travel agents in Ireland and tour operators. And this airline called Ryanair had started to fly to some more unusual destinations that Irish people traditionally hadn't gone to. So that Irish people would fly to New York for a week, for a week, or London or Paris or Amsterdam. But Ryanair started flying to these, you know, places called Bratislava and Krakow and et cetera. And so I had already got, you know, maybe 20 people that worked with me. I had Grace, I had Patrick. Just before my marriage actually broke down, I had become good friends with somebody in Ryanair, Caroline Green, who was one of the directors. And they had a massive call centre over in the Phoenix Park with 350 people who were booking flights for the travel agents and the general public, because this was all pre-internet. So I became friends with Caroline, and visiting Cunningham Road one day, I said, you're effectively the biggest travel agent in Ireland and I want you as my client. Mm-hmm. So I introduced I think I was the first company in the world to partner with an airline, so that when people were ringing to book a flight, they'd say, do you need a hotel? And they'd switch the call through to the desk that I had in the Ryanair call centre. And we started converting an unbelievable volume of hotel rooms from the cheapest two stars to like top deluxes all over the world.
Like the click and go sort of thing now. I mean, that's like the original version
so,
of that.
So we went live in the call centre with Ryanair in 1999. Mm-hmm. And in 2001, Ryanair went live with Ryanair.com, which is when you could book your flight online real time.
Sure.
And we interfaced our reservation system with that. So we were RyanairHotels.com, but we launched like 2 weeks before 9/11. And at that, I remember sitting crying, saying to our staff, you know, I think we might have made a really bad career decision here, because I don't think anybody's ever going to travel again.
Yeah.
And that was my honest feeling. I thought everybody would be too afraid.
Yeah.
But then the genius that Michael O'Leary is gave away 1 million free seats. And lo and behold, everybody decided that, okay, well, why not take the risk?
You weren't afraid anymore.
And they all booked hotels.
And so began. And that's
and
when
so began.
You started to kind of make your way, I was going to say drift, but actually hurtling towards your Dallas/Dynasty dream come true, because obviously you made a nice fortune in due course, and you had all the things that go with it: house in Shrewsbury Road, a chalet in, was it Switzerland?
Zermatt. I went to Zermatt one weekend to a party, and might have had one or two many glühweins. Met somebody that owned a field, And I bought it along with the goats.
The full sound of music full experience.
Heidi and Peter, High on a Hill. And I bought a field with goats on, and it happened to have planning permission. So I built Chalet Grace, which is named after my daughter. My son was a little bit upset that I didn't name it after him, but his name is Paddy, and I didn't think it would have quite the same...
Paddy Field then, wouldn't it?
Paddy Field, yeah. I didn't think Chalet Paddy would have quite the same, you know, tone. So I built a super chalet.
What did it have in it that we'd all be loving?
Oh, it had a cinema. It had a whole wellness floor with a sauna, jacuzzi, outdoor hot tub, whole room for Pilates, yoga, meditation. Obviously, it had a huge bar for après-ski drinking. It had a snooker room. And most importantly, it had a butler.
Did it really?
Yeah, and he was called Zoltan.
Of course he was.
And he was fantastic. And he just knew what you wanted.
How long did you have that place for?
Well, it took me about nearly 2 years to build with the help of some very good friends. You know who you are. And I ran it as a business, actually, for 2 seasons and would charge a lot of money for 16 people to stay and be cooked and looked after and taken skiing, etc. And it was a really, really great business.
And what sort of car were you driving? Let's be vulgar for a moment and ask that sort of thing.
Like in okay, terms of, vulgar. Yeah. Well, first of all, I'd like to just say something like inadverted commas that I say to my friends when we've had a glass or two of wine is I was born to be driven, first of all. Sitting in the back. I had a Range Rover.
Yeah.
And I had a Porsche and I had a bicycle.
Yeah.
So I wasn't that like mad.
You had three sets of wheels.
Yeah. Well, actually four, because you had the use of a private plane as well.
Oh, no. So. Well, I would have said wings for that one rather than wheels, but yeah.
They would have wheels too.
How would you describe your greatest extravagance of that time apart from the chalet?
Well, the chalet was a business, okay? And I also had similar places in Ireland, in golf courses. I had one in Vancouver, overlooking the Lionsgate Bridge, because really what I was doing was building a small luxury boutique chain. Okay. So it wasn't just, oh, I think I'll pop over there and buy a villa or a chalet because I can. It was actually a business plan that went horribly wrong. Greatest extravagance was getting a plane, and honestly, it was the best fun ever. Really was. I don't regret a minute of it. And mostly because my lovely, darling grandparents, my nanny Gwendolyn, my grandparents had dementia and I was so busy and it was really hard to see them. And they were really, my nanny was the love of my life. And so I used to get my mum to fly them over to Ireland or wherever I was and they would arrive. And I can tell you when you're dementia-ridden grandmother who's terribly glamorous arrives at your house and she says, darling, Ryanair is very good. You know, that puts a smile on your face.
Okay.
And it was worth every penny.
Wait, you said things go horribly wrong. When did you get an inkling that you're in trouble? What year was that?
I think it was 2009 or 10. I can't quite remember. I try to not remember, but... Yeah.
And Sarah, if you could tell me, how quickly did it unravel in time-wise? Was it months or years or days?
No, it was probably over a couple of years because I always believe in, you know, great optimism that you could work these things out.
Sure.
And at the time, I think we had the greatest recession that the world has ever seen. And so nobody really knew what was going on.
Yeah.
So it just, everything took time, but the pressure mounted and mounted and mounted.
Could you see it and feel it crumbling under your feet?
Not really. I just felt horrific pressure and I always thought I'd find a solution. I thought there'd be a solution out there somewhere. So it didn't just hit me overnight that, wow, things are not great. It was a gradual, frightening time.
And if your business was sold for approximately 50 million euro or thereabouts, that's the figure that we read about. Did you lose everything?
Everything.
Everything?
Everything.
Every cent?
Every single cent.
And was that money on paper or was that in an account? I mean,
it was like bank shares. And I'm not alone. There's lots of people, your listeners, who invested huge sums of money. Their pensions were in bank shares, gone. They go overnight. I invested in some people's companies and they were unable to pay me back. I invested a lot in property in Ireland. Actually, whilst I take full responsibility for the mistakes that I've made, and that it, I only lost my own money, not, you know, I didn't like embezzle anything from anybody else. Yeah. But the valuations that were put on properties that we were going to buy, will we trust those people? The banks won't lend money if there isn't a valuation done on that particular property.
Yes.
And then they do a loan to value ratio. There isn't one person in this country that hasn't had that experience. You want to buy something, it must be valued, and then the bank decide how much they'll lend you.
Yes.
I was wined and dined by financial institutions, and they're the grown-ups that tell you this is the future in property and keep building and we'll keep lending. And to be honest with you, I always thought that I was an imposter in my own success because I left school with two O-levels. Mm. Back to the cookery mm. and drama, which is my whole life. I got an A for that.
You and me both.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so I'm not blame. I'm just saying it is what it is. But I believe it's like when you know, if you're sick, you go see your GP.
Yes.
And they tell you what they think might be wrong with you, and they because you respect them.
I also think some there's a school of thought, I suppose, that says that when it comes to financials and speculation and property and business, that it's a bit like the craps table at Vegas. Like, if you can afford to throw the dice and play for high stakes, you're in that zone. Other people will say, well, we didn't gamble, so therefore, you know, but that expression,
yeah.
We all went mad, we all partied. A lot of people say, well, actually, I didn't party. I saw we were screwed. I saw that I had to pay a lot of tax.
Yeah.
So I just actually reined it in.
Yes. And you know what? I actually quite often envy people that are content with being actually a lot more conservative
and cautious,
because you know what, I this is in my blood. I am an entrepreneur.
Let me ask you about that sense of losing everything. Mm. I mean, that didn't happen overnight. You just said that a couple of years, whatever. When did it make you feel sick, unwell?
Probably around there were two things. There was when a relationship broke down, and that was very public at the same time as having, you know, judgments against me.
There was enormous interest in that relationship with, obviously, DJ Carey. He was one of the most popular sports people on the island at the time. And for whatever reason, I seem to recall you were in the paper every other day about this.
Literally, when it broke up, I think that we were in the one of the papers. I won't give them the pleasure of naming them. Mm-hmm. Like 6 days in a row. And you know what the most embarrassing thing was? At the time, they used to give away those papers on as you get on board Aer Lingus to fly to London. And that week, I had to fly twice to London. And everybody in their hand has got a picture of a paper that's talking about the breakdown of my relationship. I cannot tell you how humiliating and hurtful that is. It's not necessarily the words were hurtful, but it's just the fact that I may as well have stood naked in the airport. Maybe if I'd have stood naked, they would have all run away and dropped their papers.
No, I doubt that. But the papers will say, well, look, when the good times were there, you might have courted them.
I don't believe
too much. And that
you
might have got credit or coverage for it. And therefore, there are good times and there are bad times. And, you know, that's how it rolls. It's not pretty.
Yeah, you can say that. Yeah. That is the nature of the beast that is. If you do well in your business, you get reported on. And if things go wrong, yeah, they can give you a kicking. But I still don't believe that that's right.
Now, you said around this time you started to feel sick. Was that mental illness or physical illness?
It was mental illness.
Yeah.
Deep depression. Couldn't get out of bed. If it wasn't for my wonderful housekeeper at the time, Joan, while I still could afford to pay her. now she's just a great friend. Joan got me out of bed and made me eat soup and put me in the shower. I just stopped. Everything just, I couldn't function.
What did waking up feel like at that time?
I'd open my eyes and I'd wish that I, oh my God, I'm awake again. I'd actually just wish that I wouldn't be there. And that's something that's very, very hard to be, you know, I'm getting emotional now, but it's very hard to speak about that when I know that, you know, my mum is listening, my wonderful friends that saved my life are listening, my kids, you know, they saw how devastated I was and I couldn't get out of it. Black hole, just black.
For how long?
2 or 3 years.
It's a long time.
Yeah.
Like a week is a long time.
A week is a long time in that life. It's really tough.
Really tough. Does it feel like a foot on your head? Is it like that sense of not being able to lift your head off the pillow?
Yeah, you just couldn't. Like when things are really bad, this is my journey.
I
Other people
that.
May be totally different.
No, absolutely.
But for me, I'd find myself in the supermarket.
Yeah.
And say, I really want a tin of Heinz beans. I love all things Irish, by the way, but you can't beat a tin of Heinz beans. Okay. So I'd go around the supermarket, and if I couldn't find them, I would stand there and cry.
Helpless.
Utterly helpless that tin of beans was my saviour, because it would remind me of being, you know, when you'd be poorly at home, you'd have, you know, beans on toast. And, you know, maybe tomato soup or whatever you were going to have.
Comfort,
and it
comfort,
was that comfort food. And so the paralysis is extraordinary. And yet I'm really strong, outgoing.
Yeah, yeah.
Some say bossy. I don't know about that. But, you know, it was crippling.
Was noise a problem?
Yeah, noise was a huge problem.
What sort of noise?
Like I couldn't bear everything was all my senses were heightened. So if people made noise, I couldn't bear that. And then I actually got sick as well. So that added on to it.
In
so I got
sense?
A real kicking. I had a VAD,
which is
called a vertebral arterial dissection. That was 5 years ago. And that's what they, at that time, because I Googled it, because I wondered what was wrong with me, is a stroke in young people, mm-hmm. young being under 45.
Yes.
And I was 45, so I was delighted that
you're
I was still
young.
Called young.
Yeah, you were very young. Yeah.
And actually, it was your brother was my consultant.
Well, you got the best in the land.
I certainly did. Yeah.
No, but he is brilliant at his job, Neil.
He's brilliant.
I didn't know you'd been to see him, by the way. He's very discreet.
No, he's very discreet, yeah.
I
was actually on my way.
I recuse myself probably from talking about this, but.
No, you're quite all right. You know, and I think I'm public health,
sure.
And they were just fantastic.
Good.
I didn't get any special treatment. I was on my way to the airport, actually, to fly to London, and I'd started feeling like I got vertigo. So I just kept kind of like walking into walls and things. I thought, oh, my God, I really am going nuts. And Patrick, my son, was going back to boarding in Blackrock College, mm-hmm. and he was dropping me at the air coach to go to the airport. And I felt so dreadful. And Patrick, and I said, you have to bring me to the doctors now. So I walked into a doctor's surgery. The female doctor examined me and said, I think you are having a stroke.
Good Lord, in mid-stroke.
Yeah. So I was pretty sick for a while. But your brother and all the people, all the wonderful staff in Vincent's, I kind of don't remember a whole week. And they kept running lots of tests. And eventually they discovered this small tear in an artery in the back of my neck. So that really shut me up for another 6 months.
Been through the wars, haven't you?
Yeah, slightly.
Slightly. Can we talk about coming home from the front then, if to use the analogy?
Yes.
Where are you now? You seem very happy. I mean, you came in here, you bounced in. You don't look like somebody who's still struggling, but then you could be internalizing. I don't know.
No, do you know what, Ryan? Here's the thing. Where am I now? I'm in Dublin and I'm in the UK. Spend a lot more time with my mum and my wonderful friends in the UK, some of whom who, you know, literally wrapped me up in blankets, Joe and Dan, and were folk so kind to me. And then I went through a process with a psychologist.
Yeah. Yeah.
I got medication.
Yeah.
And I worked really, really hard on how can I get better. And that's mind, body, spirit. It's not just a one-stop shop,
sure.
Take a few tablets and everything goes away. I had to cope with, you know, the working out how I made the decisions that I made, why I made them. What was out of my control. And then the big thing is the letting go. So I'm like full of love now.
Oh, good.
I've no even if I don't like someone, I'll give them a hug and like them. Like, I just don't want to carry any negativity.
Or toxicity.
No toxicity. I'll only spend, I can't believe I could say that, toxicity.
With ease.
With ease, yes.
That'll and be only the coffee. Coffee.
Yeah, that'll be the coffee.
But tell me, what are you working? Do you have a job or are you sort of between?
No, well, the thing is, I don't have a job because I've got two O levels. So I'm more of I'm what they call.
I thought you'd open up a coffee shop and sell only apple crumble.
And there's an idea.
The quiche Lorraine. That's the main course of the dessert right there.
It's like, what's the menu? There is no menu. Do you want food or not?
Quiche and crumble, get out.
Yeah, get out. Off you go. Leave a tip or else we'll trip you over on the way out.
Correct.
Okay, so I say I'm unemployable. That doesn't mean that if you, I call myself a consultant.
Okay.
Which means I'm a mystery. So I have a consultancy called Bizkit,
yes,
which is named after my poodle. And I go into companies that want me and I listen to their problems and I talk them through and I might meet the management or the CEO. And I just apply a practical, common sense approach to help them achieve what they want to achieve.
Yeah, because the crash didn't affect your ability to be an excellent business person. It was just the crash for the circumstances that killed a lot of people off financially.
Yes.
You know, you're still in, your intellect hasn't been affected by a global horror show.
No, and that will then lead me to, I was still able, once I got better,
sure,
to do a job.
Yeah.
And that's why I work a lot with ex-military people in the UK, okay, and I'm beginning to start to do it in Ireland as well. So I work with an amazing guy called Steve Maguire, Cyber Forces Pathways, and what we do, and I've done this for like 5 years.
Okay.
I help particularly wounded, injured, sick, medically discharged people from the Defence Forces or the British military. So people who are suffering terribly with PTSD, which I can totally relate to, people that have lost limbs, they can never do their job again. I lost money.
Yeah.
They can't ever be, you know, a paratrooper or a Royal Marine. And so I started doing some stuff with ex-military people and realizing how when you leave, you know, those type of roles, you're lost. So I help them find new careers. And there's a brilliant government levy, which I think we should bring into this country.
Yes.
So there's a government levy in the UK for any company that has a payroll of in excess of 3 million sterling a year has to pay something like half of 1% into a government levy. And the company can only access that money that's taken every month.
From the role, yeah.
They can only spend it if they go to a training provider and they access that money and it's spent on training apprentices. And apprentices for me and for everybody else concerned should be between, you know, 16 years of age and into their 80s. Retrain people who might be retired, might just not have a job, and retrain them in cybersecurity or IT tech and get them back into the workforce.
It makes great sense. Tech says, as a business person going through a liquidation, I'm inspired by Sarah Newman this morning, can see how there is life after failure. Another says, thanks for putting both sides to the property bust. It's great to hear somebody having a balanced view. Nobody was forced to buy anything. And Dragon's Den was never the same after Sarah left. I always thought she would do great as a TV presenter. She is sassy, she is funny, and oh so glamorous, if you don't mind. Let's leave it on that upbeat note. Sarah Newman, happy Christmas to you, to
happy
your mom,
Christmas.
To Grace, to Patrick, to all your friends who minded you when you needed it most, and more importantly, to yourself. Lovely to see you.
Lovely to see you, thanks for having me.
Not at all. It's 6 minutes
Bye.
To 10. 9:25 this Tuesday morning, 10th of December. Great to have you with us. It is a horrible report that might have passed you by over the weekend, but I want to mention it about, because it was in the news with Safe Ireland, one of the organisations I have the greatest time for the work they do in the area of domestic violence. And this report talked about, that I'm reading from the Irish Times of the weekend, domestic homicides have outpaced gangland murders by almost 2-1. In the last 3 years, but still generates far less coverage and discussion. This is from Drew Harris, the Garda Commissioner. He was making a speech and said that Gardaí are now responding to 30,000 domestic abuse calls every year, which works out at 500 to 600 per week. It was quite shocking. He said this is mainstream work for the Garda. There is a constant drumbeat of this type of call. And there were 40 domestic homicides between 2016 and 18. And during the same period, which included the most violent time of the Hutch-Kinahan feud, there were 26 organised crime homicides thereabouts, 26 to 40. It's not a competition, not a race to the bottom, just a matter of fact. It's quite grim news, which is why we've asked Padraig O'Rochtagan to come and join us this morning. Padraig, good morning to you.
Morning, Ryan. Thank you for having me.
I was talking about you yesterday morning on the radio because you had made the news having been named Dentist of the Year following some big news over the weekend. Can you tell us why you won this award?
I was nominated by a patient of mine who had some very difficult times in her life outside of her dental problems. And I was lucky to be the conduit by which she was able to help her family and to deal with a very, very difficult situation in relation to domestic violence.
So she had contacted you on a Saturday morning out of hours.
That's right.
Is that right? And you opened your dental practice to look after her.
Yeah.
She'd been, I presume, attacked by a man of some sort.
The details are
without getting into
something
the,
that I need to keep to
I
myself.
But she had a dental issue relating to domestic violence. Okay.
And as the consultation progressed, it became clear that she had no confidant. She had never spoken to anybody
really
about many years of domestic violence. She had young children. And you're probably familiar with going to the dentist and busy people we are. We give you the shot and we tell you to go sit in the waiting room for 5 minutes and 20 minutes later we get back to you. In these circumstances, because I'd opened the practice, there was nobody else there. So I sat with her and whatever way, the look in her eye or the look in my eye or whatever, she chose to tell me what happened and how it happened. And we had many visits to deal with her dental problems. And over that time, the story became more expanded upon at each visit. And it seems that our chats were the catalyst which caused her to take the action that she needed to do to take to keep her family safe.
She was guided in the right direction then.
Yeah.
Great. And then as a result of that, then she came out the other side, hopefully, of that. And I'm keen to get away from her story, so it was not to identify. But,
sure.
But suffice to say that she was given an award of €1,500, I understand, by Colgate, who run the Irish Dentist of the Year, appropriately enough, I suppose. And she donated that straight to Women's Aid.
Yes.
Which was in itself a lovely kind of circle of kindness between you, her and Women's Aid.
Absolutely, yes.
Everyone's kind of winning there from an ugly situation
yes.
from the get-go. And the reason I wanted to talk to you in many respects this morning, Padraig, was because your background brings us back across the Irish Sea, like so many other people in the, was it the 80s you would have
That's
left
right.
Ireland?
Yep.
You're on, you know that scene in Reeling in the Ears where you, won't you remember, as they're all getting on the bus to London. It's the saddest bloody picture. But nevertheless, you were one of those and you started a life in the UK. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. You just reminded me about the other picture, which is the shot from the back of the ferry leaving Dunleary with
yes.
the white water.
Yeah.
And that was me, actually.
Was that you?
I was on that ferry. And I worked first in Kent as an associate or an assistant dentist in a practice. An extremely important part of my career because you leave college knowing everything. And after a week's work, you realise you know nothing. And you're mentored by the dentists who
sure.
have more experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I always look back with gratitude on my time as an associate. I then bought my own practice in the East End of London. And it was there that I was first exposed to the whole business of domestic abuse. Language wasn't as politically correct in those days. And these ladies were referred to as battered wives.
Yeah, I remember the language, yeah.
And close to my practice, there was a refuge for battered wives
mm-hmm.
where women from all over the country who were at immediate serious risk were brought. and the location was never known to me. It was kept secret. And I suppose around 1998, these patients, these women were brought into me if they had dental injuries because I was the nearest dentist to the the centre.
Sure.
And I think around 1998, a lady was brought into me who was in her 70s. And she, let's say she was from an aristocratic background. And she had been beaten black and blue all over with one of those walking canes that posh people carry with the ball on the top as distinct from the handle of the cane.
A Victorian cane.
Yeah. And she had broken her denture. Well, she hadn't. Her denture had been broken. So we fixed the denture for her. And I was told a few days later that she'd passed away. And she told me while she was in as much as she could, while she was in with me, that all her married life had been like that.
Beaten up.
Yeah. And I have never forgotten. I have never forgotten that woman. And now, ever since really, I'm inclined to inquire gently about an injury. My patients will know that. They'll recognise the fact that I asked them and it was a gardening accident or whatever. Mm. But I think it's important that we should show concern about any injury that we see and give people an opportunity to tell you about it if that's what they want to do.
Can you tell me the nature of the injuries that you talk about in the UK that women from the, what were called, as you say, battered wives, refuges, would come in? What sort of things, if we take it out of the abstract and into your personal experience, what was happening to them? What sort of damage was being done to these people?
Ryan, it was varied to the extent that any victim of a car crash that you see in a hospital or on TV in the 24-hour A&E series, they come in like that. Black eyes, broken noses, dried blood on the wounds that have been inflicted on them because they haven't been to the hospital yet. And it was the sort of stuff that we dentists deal with on an occasional basis in terms of accidents. But in these circumstances, there was an extra dimension to it because you knew somebody had done that deliberately.
Is there a Hippocratic Oath? Is there the seal of the confessional in that if you have somebody, this is a hypothetical, on the chair, let's say the husband's sitting outside in the car, you know right well because she says, I don't tell anyone, but have you anywhere to go with that?
I'm really glad you asked that question because the situation now is very interesting.
Is it?
In that if, for example,
yeah,
a small lady in physical stature mm-hmm. presents to me with an injury, and she's over 16 years old, as I think that's right, and I suspect strongly that she has been the victim of an assault. I have no legal
recourse
yeah. nor have I any legal responsibility to take any action in that regard. However, if it's a 14-year-old, I have a duty to report a suspected injury to a child.
What if a woman over 16, like so an adult, mm-hmm. says to you, my partner, husband, father smashed my jaw, which is why I'm here with you today. Do you just have to fix her and say goodbye?
But that's not what I would do.
I know you wouldn't do that.
My clinical responsibility extends to treating her injuries.
Precisely, but the responsibility of the soul says what?
Says that you've got to talk to the person and see where it's going to go.
Yeah. It's a trick I've never crossed my mind until you won this award at the weekend. No, honestly, because it brings up that conversation. And these people, and any time we talk about domestic violence, there will be a section of people, men, who will say, don't forget, we are beaten up too by women in relationships and this can happen too. So I'm cognizant of that. But I suppose it's just they come in before you and they sit in the chair and we see them on the bus or we might see them buying mince pies and trying to get on with their lives. How much should we do How, you know, if we hear this, the thumps and the screams through the thin walls next door, I wonder. I'm only asking as one guy to another sitting here.
I don't know,
do we make the call? Are we causing more trouble for the person? It's hard to know.
No, it's very interesting you brought that point up.
God, because
yesterday afternoon,
yeah,
a long-standing patient of mine, a really lovely lady, who knew the story,
yeah,
sat in the chair and she said, "You were so brave." I'm like, I don't get that bit.
Yeah.
I said, I did what I felt was right. I listened and I gave advice. And I'm old enough and long enough on the tooth to be able to give advice that sometimes people listen to. No, she said, you don't get it. I said, what don't I get? She said, you're a man. And I go, yeah. But she said most men would run for cover in that sort of situation.
Interesting.
That was probably, you know, the most seminal thing that anybody said to me yesterday about, which I'd never thought about, because clearly this has been going through my mind for a year now, you know.
Why do men run for cover?
I never asked her.
No, but I'm curious. The reason I asked the question is because I mentioned Safe Ireland there before and the work they do. And I don't mean to bring it to me, but just for the purpose of this conversation, where they say, would you front up a campaign called Man Up? Which was to get men to talk about domestic violence, not necessarily on the radio, but just for a campaign they were doing a few years ago. It stayed with me because, and I was kind of aware that here we are, two men talking about domestic violence. So I'm acutely aware of that too. But their point was, and that's why I don't mind so much, is that if men talk about it, whether they're having a pint or a coffee, it makes it less taboo, and it makes it more. So to go back to that lady you talked about yesterday, it means that we won't run away.
Mm-hmm.
We will man up, to use that, which now feels like an archaic expression, but let's face it, that's what it was. We will stand up and say, not good enough. And that's the point she's made. And it resonated with you. Why did that resonate with you so much, I wonder?
It was just a point of view that I'd never even thought about or considered. But she also told me that the lady was just incredible because it's so embarrassing to talk about it. And I said to her, why would it be? Because I can't get my head around this.
Yeah.
I said, why would it be embarrassing? And she said, because she said she would see it as a failure on her part that caused the problem in the first place.
Yeah.
And I was totally blown away with that because nobody like me or you or anybody walking down the street would see it as a failure that someone would get beaten up on a regular basis just for being there.
Oh, listen, if I've learned one lesson in 2019, it is the absolute perversion of the word shame by perpetrators of crime, particularly sex crimes or domestic violence, where they make the victim feel shameful or ashamed.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it's completely the other way around. The person who throws a thump, a shove, who does something unspeakable to another human being, there lies the shame. Not the person who's in the corner saying, please don't do it again.
Yep.
We've got to get that right.
Yep.
You know, you brought your family back. You don't have a hint of English accent.
No, no.
You know, some people go to the UK for a weekend, they come back sounding like Jamie Oliver. No, but you know what I mean.
I've had a very broad spread of patience throughout my life because after a few, I suppose 5 or 6 years in the East End, I moved to a practice in Wimpole Street in central London.
Yes.
Which was from the socioeconomic strata that we all lived through was at the very top end. And I spent 2 or 3 years there. And then my children were coming to the age where school was becoming an issue. And I was so happy in my own childhood where I grew up in Cullohill in County Laois that I wanted my children to have, my wife will kill me, I wanted our children to have the same sort of upbringing as I had. And thankfully they did, and they're very happy and well-adjusted kids.
I always wonder, and I'll put this to you with a whimsical grin, Did you want your children to have Irish accents and not English accents, or did that cross your mind at all?
No, that never crossed
did
my mind.
Did it not? I often wonder that sometimes with the, I talk to some people who come home going, I couldn't handle, Daddy, Mummy, you know, I couldn't handle. And how are your kids doing now?
They're great. Tara is an engineer in the ESB and Claire is a physiotherapist and she's working with the HSE at the minute.
Congratulations. So yeah. Two girls. I mean, two girls. I wonder, does that, I mean, they're women now, would that colour your sense
of empathy? Thinking that, you know, last night, because I have four sisters and no brothers.
Have you?
My life has been surrounded by women.
And what a good effect that's had on you.
Perhaps. My father asked me on Sunday, he said, where did you get the compassion from?
Well, the fact that he asked the question, you can thank your sisters for that. And your mother, no doubt. Here's a text that says, thank you for having the conversation about domestic abuse. Listening to two men having the conversation is one way of saying this is not okay to men who think it is. And that tallies with the point we were making earlier on, which I'm glad to see. And I appreciate that text very much, 51551. And Maria is in West Cork and says, as we're talking to Padraig this morning, what an amazing, understanding, compassionate and caring dentist. Good for him. I have no doubt he's representing a lot of dentists out there who are working away quietly in the background, listening to people who have nowhere else to go. I mean, do you find yourself a kind of counsellor the way some teachers would, you know, above and beyond the core duty of the day, given day?
You know what? The day is so varied, right?
I can imagine.
You put on a different face 20 times a day because each person is different. And some people want to teach you and other people you want to teach them. And then there's another whole batch in the middle who just want you to get on with it and shut up.
Yeah, okay.
But what really interests me about that point,
yes,
and it's absolutely true. So many dentists are out there listening to this or half listening to it because they're busy doing their work. And all of them are doing much what I do. I'm not here because I did anything wonderful. I'm here because I was a conduit which helped one of my patients. And that's what we do every day. And I'm delighted that we get an opportunity occasionally to present the positive side of dentistry. Yeah, yeah. And this is one of those circumstances. And if I might continue, at my acceptance speech on Saturday, I was amazed that there were so many dentists in the room. And I wasn't amazed that there were so many of them younger than me. I was one of the four oldest people, dentists in the room. And there were an awful lot of young dentists there. And one of the points that I made was that patients will never remember us after 39 years. I know they will never remember us for a brilliant crown or a lovely denture. They will remember us for a kind word.
Well said.
Or a little chat after someone's spouse has died. Mm-hmm. Someone that you knew. Mm. They remembered the kindness. Not sure. You're expected to do your day's work.
Sure.
But they remembered the kindness. And afterwards, about 50 young dentists came up to me and congratulated me. And they all used the same word. And it was inspirational.
Great.
And that word meant so much to me because it's so important that young dentists get an opportunity to understand empathy, and they all have empathy, but how to express it properly is often a difficulty for them because they have no experience. And one of the really sad things about young dentists and their training is that on the day they got there, they get their certificate. 38 years ago today, in my case.
Congratulations. Happy anniversary.
Thank you. They walk out into the wide world and there's no further mentoring, no further training, no vocational training for them. Mm. And they're exposed to all these really difficult problems that crop up in today's world without a clue.
Yeah. Yeah. So that would be something worth thinking about
in
the dental world. Mm-hmm. Ray says, I was at the Irish Dental Association Awards on Saturday and Paddy's story, as I call you here, brought a tear to my eye, which is lovely. But well done to Paddy, says the text. As a social worker, I see the impact of domestic violence on children who are also are victims by witnessing and living in a toxic environment. And I want to thank him and wish him a happy Christmas. You got a lot of thanks, is that right, from people all around the place? You wanted to say thanks to them for thanking you.
if I have a second, can I respond to that text message? We had a phone call yesterday from a lady in the west of the country. Mm-hmm. She went to the trouble of finding my telephone number, Googled me or whatever.
Sure.
And she called the practice and she spoke to my receptionist for about 3 or 4 minutes. And she was very complimentary about what I had done. And she said that she came from a background where her father was an alcoholic and they suffered the consequences of domestic abuse all through their childhood. But she said, don't forget, domestic abuse in front of children lives with them all their lives.
I'd say it haunts them, yeah.
And on that note, I'd like to thank the hundreds of people who made comments on the Irish Times Facebook page, the hundreds of people who've been in touch with me personally, my friends, my colleagues, my patients, the people who call to my practice. People from Australia, people from Qatar, people from the UK have sent me messages. This has gone way beyond what I thought it was. And finally, from a thanks perspective, Ryan, I truly, truly want to thank the lady who nominated me.
Likewise. Yeah.
She is totally the hero in all of this.
Yeah.
All I was the cable.
Yeah.
The media cable that allowed her to get to where she is today. And I am so happy that she's safe. Yeah. And I am so happy that she can now get on with her life.
I think just to reflect on what you were saying about all the thanks that came into you and kind words, there is an insatiable appetite for kindness and for decency, really. And you gave a sample of that. And people were, I think, responding to that. So that's why it was such a pleasure to meet you and to have you here today. And to wish you well and your family a happy Christmas.
Thank you very much,
and
Ryan.
Thanks for what you did, because it's a position that, to me, of leadership in the kindest possible way, and what a perfect time of the year to talk to you about that. So mind yourself, and thanks for coming in to see us today. Are you working today,
thanks,
or
Matt.
Are you off today?
No, today is the day off.
Thank God, you deserve it. You do well, sir. Paddy Padraig O'Rachtagán, thanks for your time this morning. You're based in Roscrea.
In Roscrea, County Tipperary.
And I hope you have just a wonderful Christmas with the family.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for your time. It's 13 minutes to 10. 9:29 this Wednesday morning. My guest this morning spent most of his life working as an esteemed botanist and senior curator in the beautiful Natural History Museum in London. But his career took a very grisly turn when one day he answered a phone call from the police. His name is Dr. Mark A. Spencer. He joins us now. Good morning, Mark. Nice to talk to you this morning.
Good morning. It's nice to be talking to you as well.
Well, I think you might be the first botanist I've ever met. I'd love to know, what does the 9, 10, 11-year-old Mark A. Spencer, if you could bring him back to kind of his Christmas days around that, was he looking for from Santa?
Well, actually, even earlier on, pretty much the whole of my life, I can remember thinking, oh, you know, plants, plants, plants. I even dream about plants. I have done the whole of my life. So, you know, books on gardening, you know, back in the 1970s when I was a lad, you know, my family all thought of me as going to be the new Percy Thrower.
I was just writing down Percy Thrower on my sheet in front of me. He was the Blue Peter Gardener. So we're getting,
Absolutely.
We might be roughly the same age, Mark.
A national hero, yes.
Yeah, okay. But, I mean, what was it about the outdoors life? The gardens, the forest, the leaves, the ferns, everything. What was it doing for you?
Well, plants are just a space and a thing of great beauty that you can lose yourself in. So there's the aesthetic appeal of plants. You know, you can just be in a wonderful space and see great colours, great shapes and all those kind of things. And they're incredibly good for our well-being. But, you know, I just find them amazingly fascinating as a scientist. You know, what they do on the world, what they do in terms of ecology and the environment, how they function and, you know, how we depend upon them. So there's not really a thing about plants which isn't fascinating, basically.
So essentially then, Mark, when you finished school and university of Reading, where you did your PhD and studied botany, as I understand, you got what I can only imagine was the dream job. You got to the mecca of botany, the Natural History Museum in London.
Well, we're very lucky because, you know, we've got the Natural History Museum and down the road we've also got Kew Gardens, two of the most important institutions for botany collections in the world. So, you know, I was pretty much in heaven, really. You know, it is quite an amazing experience to walk through those doors of the Natural History Museum, and most of the public see dinosaurs and rocks and minerals and sort of bears and things. But behind those doors, which say private, we have 80 million objects. and I was very lucky to look after a mere 620,000 of them. So it's an extraordinary experience being behind those closed doors and working with amazing people and also with amazing collections.
I often think of the arrogance of humanity when you know, when we think of the world of botany and 80 million samples just in one building itself. You know, what for you, Mark, in a given day, as particularly in the museum, going back a little bit, what for you was like a gold medal day? What how did you feel when you punched the air with joy? What did it take for that to happen?
Probably after I'd had my first cup of coffee, that would be happening. But I think one of the great wonders of the Natural History Museum is being able to look at an object which you know somebody collected, you know, 400 years ago, exploring a new part of the world and holding something which has not been held by a Western scientist before and examining it and going, wow, this is amazing. This is hundreds of years old and we can still marvel at it and still do science with it. So, you know, I have to say, there's not many things in the shelves of the Natural History Museum that don't tell a tale. They're all amazing things.
There's a touch of the kind of Indiana Jones, but with a better smell off you. I mean, there's a sense that it's like a botanical archaeology almost.
Well, certainly, you know, natural history collections, we think of them as these things that, you know, mad scientists and botanists go out and collect, put on shelves and forget about. But they're much, much more than that. That we can use them to explore all sorts of aspects of the natural world, things like climate change, somewhat topical at the moment, because they are locked in environmental samples in many ways. So it is a sort of internal Indiana Jones in many ways. But it's also very much an external one because we are still collecting to this very day. It's not really a case of sort of Noah's Ark syndrome, where we get a representation and put it in the cupboard. We need to keep on collecting and keep on understanding the world, because the natural world is changing very fast, and the only way we can really understand that change is through more collecting.
Well, let me go then, if I may, Mark, to that that extraordinary day that changed your life, when I think you were at your desk at the Natural History Museum in London. The phone rang. It was a day like any other, except that the person at the other end of the phone was not a typical, I suppose, caller to your desk. Tell us about that phone call.
Well, the phone rang, and I was, my office in that particular office was somewhat grey and a little bit drab. So it was someone like, oh, you know, new colleague going to pick up the phone and speak to them. And it was somebody representing a police force saying, we need your help, Dr. Spencer. Can you help us estimate how long a man who'd been dead lying by a river, how long he'd been dead for? And I was like, ooh, so what do you think I can do? And they were, well, there's lots of vegetation around the man's remains. And we think you may be able to look at the vegetation and estimate how long he's been lying in this vegetation. By the way, the plants are all around him. So I thought, oh, gosh, can I do this? They sent me some pictures, which were, is fair to say, rather challenging.
Yes.
And that was my first experience. And I said, well, I'm going to need to come to the site to actually examine the remains and the vegetation. And so shortly after that, I was on a train heading up to the scene to have my first experience with somebody who had been dead for a long time.
Well, I mean, I just find that fascinating that you'd be sitting there surrounded by 80 million specimens, minding 620,000 of them. And the next thing you know, you're on a train off to a crime scene where you're getting down and dirty with nature and death.
It was quite an odd experience. I must admit, as I was heading up on the train, I was starting to get a little bit of palpitation. And I remember at one point I nipped into a chemist and I bought myself a large bottle of surgical scrubbing kind of cleaner, because I was like, oh, this could be very challenging. I'd actually picked up some equipment from a colleague of mine at the Natural History Museum, because the museum has forensic entomologists who do similar work, but from an insect point of view. So they gave me a bit of a sort of calming down, it'll be fine, talk to me, and then I get on the train. But definitely your first experience is like nothing else. I remember getting there. By the time I'd actually got there, they'd removed the majority of the man's remains, but he was so badly decayed that there was still quite a lot of him there. And I remember there was a police officer who was stood nearby saying this was the worst one he'd had in 17 years. And I thought, there is absolutely no way I'm telling him that I've never, ever done this before in my life. So
why not, Mark? Why not?
Well, I think, you know, one doesn't want to come across green, you know. You know, you need to instill confidence in somebody. And appearing gauche or naive would have not helped his confidence in my ability to do my job as a botanist. And even though my experience of the human remains was new, my experience of the plants was not.
So there you are on your hands and knees examining, if I may, the remains of the clay and trying to decide, what are we looking at here? Where do you begin as a botanist and that rotting corpse?
Well, the first thing you hope for is that the police have not cleared everything away. I've been to quite a few scenes where the police stand there smiling sweetly going, well, we've strimmed the area around the body so you can get to it. I'm like, ah, you've just chopped everything up into small pieces, which is not good for us botanists. But in this particular case, he was his body was found growing in a large stand of a plant called Himalayan balsam, which is one of our most serious invasive species. And he had laid down on the ground and had died, and the vegetation had grown up around him. So his body had pressed onto the vegetation that was already there, but the plants were regrowing around him. So I was able to provide an estimate for how long he'd been there, because the police initially were not sure about the circumstances around his death and needed to get a basic understanding of the time frame for how long his remains had been there.
Amazing. And I get the impression, Mark, that you were kind of hooked after that, were you? I mean, something happened.
Well, it is an amazing experience. Sure. I mean, I must admit, my emotions were running rather high as I was heading home. But yes, it is an extraordinary experience to work with the remains of the dead and to work with the amazing people who do it full time and all the time. So, yes, I was definitely hooked. There was definitely a little bit of, oh, every time the phone rings from now on, I'm going to be waiting for another call like this.
You talk about this idea of a crushed flower stalk hiding a secret that could solve a case, or a rose bush you brushed past so casually, or the bluebell you unknowingly stepped on, or a spore lodged in a trouser turnip. This is like a Sherlockian detail that would delight people who are interested in crime drama, but it's real life too.
Oh, very much so. I mean, we tend to think of crime drama and forensics as, you know, clearly because it's human beings doing it, as very much a human environment thing. So we often, if you see a crime drama or somebody writing a book, they'll talk about what we call trace evidence, you know, little fragments of fibre, hair, little pieces of glass or you things, those kind of things. But whether we like it or not, if we've committed a crime and we, you know, take a body into a wood, or we hide some stolen goods in a wood, or for that matter, we pick up environmental information, whether that's soil, bits of pollen, leaf fragments, all of those little pieces of information, if we collect it in the right way, can provide us with a really, really good understanding of where a suspect may have been.
And you delight in the news that a body or crime scene might involve a bramble.
Well, they're probably my pet plant when it comes to crime scenes and forensics, when it comes to people who've been dead for a while. I mean, brambles are incredibly common, although they're immensely diverse. There are actually about 300 species or so, 250 species of bramble in Britain and Ireland. They're called microspecies, and people who study them are called batologists, of all things. But brambles, because they're common and they have a tendency to grow where crimes occur, they can be really useful, because that perennial growth of a bramble, if somebody's body has been lying on the ground for, say, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, the vegetation, in this case brambles, wrap around the person, they grow over them and sometimes through them, and they lock them into that environment. And that means, you know, with a little bit of practice and a bit of patience and some luck, I can look at the stems and the regrowth patterns of the brambles and estimate how many years a person has been lying there.
Amazing. I was reading a book about Arthur Conan Doyle recently, a really good book about him, and how his mentor in university was essentially the role model for Sherlock. And as you talk about what you do, I'm reminded of the mention you give to Dr. Arthur Kohler.
Oh, yes.
And how we leap from botany to forensic to Charles Lindbergh, the famous aviator, mm-hmm. and his missing baby. Could you kind of enlighten us a little bit about that 1932?
Well, the Lindbergh case is often referred to as the earliest forensic botany case. And basically, Charles Lindbergh, world famous aviator, his son was kidnapped and subsequently was found dead in a wood. And what was originally a kidnapping inquiry turned into a murder inquiry. And Curler, who is an amazing wood anatomist and forest scientist, did some beautiful work examining a homemade ladder, which was lent up against the home where the child was taken from, and was able to identify the wood mill out of literally hundreds across the eastern United States, where the wood came from, and the other elements of the ladder, which were made from the roof space from the man who was ultimately arrested and charged and later found guilty for the child's murder. And he was able to basically put the pieces of the treads back into their original positions in the roof of the house, a bit like putting a jigsaw back together.
Honest to God. And he established that the machine tooling on the surface was made by blades rotating at 2,700 revolutions per minute. After inquiries at more than 1,500 sawmills, one was identified as the source of the wood. It was a mill where the chief suspect was known to have worked. I mean, honest to goodness.
It's pretty amazing stuff. I mean, I'm absolutely wretched at maths, and the kind of mathematical calculations he must have had to do to work out the rotational speed, etc., makes my poor brain ache.
You had a flutter, as you call it, of emotional disturbance on one case, and you kind of carried it with you a little bit.
Well, I mean, I think people often ask me this question about the emotional environment.
Yes.
And most of the time, I'm very lucky because I do this part time. I can walk away, I can relax and get away from it all. Being in it all of the time, like police officers and crime scene managers are, is very, very challenging. So sometimes there is that sort of stronger emotional feeling where you do feel quite affected by it. You know, I see and read things that would make many of us weep. So, you know, sometimes it can be a little bit too much when you hear the particularly dreadful things that some people do to others.
But you also, I think at one point you came across a victim and you went, God, that looks eerily familiar, albeit mistakenly.
Yes, there are times when I think, you know, that reminds you potentially of family and friends and those kind of things, you know, which is, you know, is not nice, frankly, you know, and knowing these things, when it reminds you of things about your own personal life, mm-hmm. it brings very much to the fore that these bodies in front of you, this body is so much more than a body. It is the last remnants of a person's life. And there are family and friends feeling very, very, very lost and full of grief. And that is it's a strangely connecting experience. I don't become angst-ridden with this desire to sort of solve the case, so to speak, and because I'm aware of the fact that I'm part of a much larger puzzle. But you feel quite strongly emotionally engaged with the person and their life and what's happened to them.
As we are on, what are we on today? The 11th of December. Mm-hmm. This is a busy time for you. You talk about the peak season of your work, which is kind of, it's dark, but it's true.
Yes. Well, one of the odd things about it is that is actually in the UK, there's not a strong seasonality in murders and crimes of that nature. They tend to happen pretty much through the year evenly. Mm-hmm. But one of the odd things that happens is that we tend to find bodies more frequently in autumn and winter, and there are two main reasons for that. One of which, well, is that actually people see human remains, usually in woodlands or hedgerows and ditches, more easily. But the other thing is, you know, their dogs, which scatter around, dog walkers in particular, they respond much more clearly to seeing a dog going into the ditch and the dog reacting. So an owner will follow through with a dog if they can see something. So because we're visual animals as opposed to scent animals, those visual clues become a lot easier for us to see. So there is definitely a sort of autumn, winter and early spring peak for finding dead people.
As we've been talking the last 20 minutes, I am just filming that Sunday evening drama on BBC One, where you are the character based on you in like an Inspector Morse type programme. It's kind of beautiful and grisly at the same time. The botanist detective. Is this happening? I mean, It has to happen.
It would be nice because, you know...
Even the title of your book, Murder Most Florid, that's the TV show. Like, I've made it in my head.
Well, you know, it would be nice. I mean, you know, you touched on beauty. You know, the natural world is a beautiful and wonderful place. And, you know, whilst death in these circumstances is tragic, you know, the biology of what happens to us after we die is extraordinary and amazing. And it is a fascinating place to be as a scientist, but it's also a really wonderful place to be as a human being helping families and friends and the dead.
I'll give you one last comment because I'm a regular enough to the Natural History Museum here in Dublin, and I've been to the one in London a few times, but I tend to head straight for the gorillas and, you know, our simian friends and so on. I tend to go right past all the botanical things, and that's being honest with you, but I have to say, after our conversation this morning, I need to rethink that. But tell me this much, as somebody who knows nothing about botany, really nothing, even though I do love nature, what should I be looking out for if I was to go to my Natural History Museum? What should we as Irish people?
Embrace your wonderful botanical heritage.
Sure.
You are so lucky. You have the Burren, you have Kerry, you have some amazing mountain systems. You know, you've got some extraordinary and unique plant life. The Burren in particular, I think, would be my fantasy botany area for Ireland. It's an extraordinary place where Mediterranean plants meet Arctic and montane plants. You have extraordinary natural heritage when it comes to plants.
Yeah, there's this beautiful road called the Sky Road in Clifton, Connemara. Do you know it?
I've not been. I've been to Kerry, and I've been around. I've got friends down around Derry Nanway and all down there.
So you're...
And I've got friends in Dublin, so I'm going to be very cheeky and say, hello, Mo.
Yeah, tell Mo you said hello.
Hi, Mo.
Is it
she's
a he or she?
Listening.
She?
She'll
good.
Be
oh, good. Now. Well, you can't let it go without saying hi to Mo. But on back to the Sky Road, the reason I mention it is because I would often walk from, say, the town up that road to a place I might be staying. Mm-hmm. And along the way, I'm always struck by what can only be a microclimate. You'll know what I'm talking about when I say what looked like Day of the Triffid style rhubarb growing at 18 feet from the ground. You know, it's like something I don't know.
That will be the dreaded gunnera, which is a South American plant.
Is it?
It was introduced into gardens, and it is emerging as one of Ireland's more serious invasive species because it is out pushing out some of your native vegetation. It's a bit of a burly beast.
Well, there's like campaigns here about the rhododendrons. People, a city slicker thinks they look beautiful, but people living with them are going doing their nut.
Well, the area around Killarney and what's happening with the rhododendrons, you know, you hear about stories about people getting lost in them, but the natural heritage of Kerry and that area of far southwest Ireland in terms of your oak forests and the amazing plant communities down there, your strawberry trees, are all imperiled by this rhododendron, sadly.
The Office of Public Works, a great department here in Ireland, would just text to say, we'd be delighted to welcome you both to the herbarium at the National Botanic Gardens here in Glasnevin. Yes. It has 800,000 species and an expert team of botany. Now, I went there for the first time, to my shame, about 2 years ago, and it was one of the most beautiful experiences I've ever had.
It's a top place, yes.
Yeah. And there's nothing like an afternoon spent walking among plants, as you well know. Mind you, that's probably a busman's holiday. You probably hate that.
No, I have, you know, my family, my friends and my partner, you know, they have got long used to the fact that I'm virtually incapable, even in central London, of walking in a straight line without bending over and looking at a weed in a crack in a pavement. So I find joy in plants wherever I am on the planet.
I don't doubt it for a minute. Mark, it's been really good to talk. Happy Christmas to you and yours, and thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you for inviting me.
Congratulations on your book, Murder Most Florid, intriguing. It's Inside the Mind of a Forensic Botanist by Dr. Mark A. Spencer. That is, if ever I heard a good one for Christmas, that's definitely has to be on the list. It's 10 to 10.